Did you know that you have bacteria in your uterus and that the types of bacteria there may impact whether you get pregnant or not? We talk all about this and many other things we are discovering that are impacting fertility with my guest, Dr. Jacqueline Smeaton. She is a fellow naturopathic doctor who has focused much of her career on fertility, and I can't wait to share this juicy and informative episode with you. Without further ado, let's get started. Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes. Did you know proper hydration and mineral balance are key for hormone health, fertility, and preparing for pregnancy? That's why Dr. Morgan and I love Relight from Redmond, the real salt people, a USA-made electrolyte powder made with unrefined sea salt and 60-plus trace minerals, plus bioavailable potassium, calcium, and two forms of magnesium. And yep, they taste amazing. I'm a lemon-lime girl, but Dr. Morgan's all about that strawberry lemonade. Head to redmond.life and use code HEALTHYMOTHER for 15% off. Again, head to redmond.life and use code HEALTHYMOTHER. Stay hydrated, ladies. Today, I get the honor of introducing someone who is not only one of the nation's top experts in women's health and infertility, but also a teacher and mentor who has deeply influenced my own journey as a doctor. Dr. Jacqueline Smeaton has spent the last two decades supporting women in reclaiming their hormonal health and fertility. Through her practice, Hello Fertility, and her leadership in the field, she has touched thousands of lives, not only patients, but also clinicians like me, who have learned so much from her wisdom and generosity in teaching. She has worn many hats over the years, from serving as president of the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians, to being an ambassador and board member in integrative medicine, now as chief medical officer at Precision Analytical, which is the company that uses the Dutch test. She most recently completed advanced certification in women's health and menopause through Harvard Medical School. But what stands out most to me about Dr. Jacqueline is her heart. She has this beautiful way of blending clinical excellence with compassion, and she's committed to elevating women's health care in a way that inspires me every day. All right, Dr. Jacqueline, thank you so much for joining me on the Healthy as a Mother podcast. I can't wait to chat with you today.
I know. I'm really excited to be here and to get to talk about something I love so much.
Yay. So I know I introduced you, but can you just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, why you're even in this field, and what, just tell us the things, the good stuff about you.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think just like so many of us who are in healthcare and in integrative medicine in particular, you know, I'm a naturopathic doctor. It's like starts with your own personal story, right? So I was a teenager, maybe 16 or 17 years old. I'd had like one menstrual period, but then never got it again, like a light bleed spotting. And so I went to see a nurse practitioner who was lovely, and she offered me the pill, the birth control pill. And she's like, okay, this will regulate your cycles. You'll be all set. And even as a teenager, I was like, this is a little weird because something's obviously wrong because something that's supposed to happen is not happening. You know, and I want to have kids later. Like, I'd like to know what's wrong. And she said, oh, don't worry. When you want to have kids later, we'll just get you on a different medication. We have medications that can help you get pregnant. And I walked out of that office, even as a teenager, feeling so just angry with the healthcare system and the fact that they didn't want to know what was wrong. I wanted to know what was wrong. And I was like, where are the tools to help me figure out what was wrong? And that really started my own interest in understanding my cycle, which I had never learned. Mm-hmm. It brought me into studying medical anthropology in college alongside biochem. So I learned about healthcare systems around the world and just a diversity of how they address things more holistically. And ultimately, it led me in doing a research project on integrative medicine. And that's where I found naturopathic medicine. I thought I would do conventional healthcare, but in the end, really fell in love with just this model. And I do think that particularly for women's health, naturopathic and integrative medicine has so many tools mm-hmm. to help women that OB-GYNs just don't have. And I'm really, really glad to have that tool, those tools in my toolkit. We can prescribe too, but hardly ever need to because there's so many other solutions.
I love that. Yeah, it's the toolkit and just our approach, right? Our perspective of seeing the body as a whole and how it's all connected. And I just love that. Well, and you've been a huge mentor and teacher for me along this journey as well. And What kind of sparked your interest in fertility in particular? Did you have any issues getting pregnant, or you just loved having kids? Like, what about fertility?
Yeah, thankfully, no. It was when I was a student in the teaching clinics, and I saw my first couple trying to conceive, and really no one had a fertility specialty at that time. Mm-hmm. And my attending physician didn't have a specialty in that. We were kind of a general practice. And I had to really dig in and start to look into it. And I really loved that work. And it led me to look for mentors in the area, and there were none. And it led me to look for books on the subject, and there were none. Mm-hmm. And this is in probably 2005. And so I found a clinic in Australia that had published a couple of research studies and ended up traveling over there, studying in their clinic. They had naturopaths, which is kind of more of like a lay mm-hmm. training there, but also acupuncturists and medical doctors in one clinic together. And I thought, well, gosh, with my training and scope of practice, I can do all of this. And it really inspired me to took what I learned there and like reading research, primary research articles. And to this day, I spend a lot of time on PubMed reading all the articles that come out and really wanting to consolidate that learning to make it easier for people to understand how to help others. And really, like, nowadays, fertility it's grown so much in awareness. Back then, no one talked about it. There weren't a lot of resources. There was just a lot of embarrassment. And yeah. I'm just so grateful today for the ability of couples to find really great information when they're trying to conceive. And so I was in private practice for years, family medicine, then moved into only fertility. I've been in practice about 20 years now, believe it or not. Wow. And now I do a lot of education and mentorship and training, and it's the best. It's like so rewarding to get the chance to help couples. I still get like Christmas cards from clients, and their kids are bigger, and it's just amazing.
That's so sweet. I love that. Yeah, it's such rewarding work. And you know, as someone who's listened to this podcast, if anyone's listened, they know my story and journey of infertility, and I help people in the fertility space too. But you in particular are so good, like you said, on PubMed and reading the research and just kind of being at the cutting edge of what's new and what's coming down the pipeline of our understanding. And it's funny because in the naturopathic world, I feel like we know and understand a lot of things, and science is very slow to catch up to a lot of what mm-hmm. we already kind of know intuitively is wisdom, and also in what we see in practice. But can you tell us what you are seeing as far as newer things, newer trends, newer things that are being studied, you know, understandings about the body or fertility that maybe we didn't know 10 or 15 years ago?
Definitely. I mean, a lot has changed. And I would say that even the conventional approach to fertility has refined so dramatically. I mean, the first IVF like pregnancy was it like in the late 70s, right? So it's like not that long ago that this even started. And now medication protocols are better. There's far more thought going into it. And then there's these like miraculous advances happening with things like ovarian rejuvenation, PRP, stuff like that, mm-hmm. that anti-aging space, and really kind of a crossover between conventional and naturopathic or functional medicine. But I would say that I think we're really starting to get a better idea of what it takes to get pregnant. And I think the more you learn, the more amazing it is that anyone gets pregnant, because literally like a million different things have to go perfectly. And when you start to think about that, it's like, oh my God, it really truly is absolutely a miracle. Mm-hmm. But we start to look at like the trends in people getting pregnant. Couples want to conceive later, particularly women. You know, it used to be that women would get pregnant in high school or just out of high school, get married young and have children really young. That's when you're in your peak fertility biologically. But now if you want to go to college or have a career, many women delay childbearing. And while that can be challenging biologically, there's some like social advantages to that too. We can definitely talk about that, because I want women to know it's not too late. And it's, you know, it's how do you protect yourself to make sure that you can have children when you want to. But we really understand a lot more about what it takes to make a healthy egg, what it takes to make a healthy sperm, what's harming our egg and sperm and causing our fertility decline. And then there's so much more now. I mean, we used to only focus on egg and sperm health, and everything after fertilization was kind of a black box. And I would say the last 5 years, we've really learned a lot about the importance of the health of the uterus, mm-hmm. The importance of the health of the immune system in order to allow implantation and healthy pregnancy to occur. And the advantages, the advances that we've gotten in those areas are so exciting and transformative. I've seen it clinically, and just the ability to understand that stuff now it's going to change the way we work with couples.
Oh, I love that. Can you dive into that more? Because I feel like we've talked about egg and sperm quality on here. I've talked a little bit about the vaginal microbiome in an old, old episode. But I there's still so much I don't even know. Tell me what you're learning, what you're seeing about that whole thing, the health of the uterus, implantation, the immune system. I'm seeing so many miscarriages, and I don't know if it's just because they're coming into my sphere or if it feels like there's more than normal. I don't know, but I would just love to hear what you know about all of that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it is really changing. So when I was in school, studying, you know, this is I started in 2003 or 2007. I was in med school. At that time, I was taught that the uterus was a sterile environment. And I think a lot of people were for quite a long time after that. And we really have thought that for a long time and ultimately we're wrong. Doesn't have a lot of bacteria. Like the biomass is different than like the gut or the vagina. But in the uterus, there are really important microbes that should live there, predominantly lactobacillus. And then there are some that can live there in very, very low levels that cause, let's just call it irritation and low levels of inflammation that can cause a lot of problems. You know, the studies go back to like the 60s where they would do hysterectomies on women, really any women who had trouble. And they found that there were pathogens in about 6% of women who had no known disease in their uterus. And really nothing happened back then after that until really the late 1990s. And they looked at women who had hysterectomies because they had things like fibroids or abnormal persistent vaginal bleeding. And they found that about a quarter of them had infectious microbes. And then they started to look into it more to figure out, well, what's happening there? But really the dogma changed, or we really started to look differently in 2004. Where we really said, okay, the uterus is not a sterile environment. We really started to connect pathogens in the uterus in very low levels and the like subsequent inflammation that happens. We call it endometritis now. Mm-hmm. Even mild endometritis actually was influencing implantation failure, which means like the second half of IVF, or if you're conceiving naturally, you just don't get pregnant, or you might get a slight temperature rise and then a drop right away around that time that you're expecting, where you're like, you think you're pregnant and then you lose it. That kind of missed pregnancy. Also preterm birth and spontaneous miscarriage. All of those are related now. At this time they proposed, it wasn't until 1995 where they thought that it was related. Wow. So really has a huge impact. And I want to share one more like super interesting study that really started to look at the microbiome within the uterus. They looked at women who had They looked at vaginal cultures as well as endometrial cultures and egg donors that were fertile. And then they looked at women who had trouble getting pregnant, and they saw totally different microbiomes in these women. It can be modified hormonally. But what they found was that women who had a lactobacillus dominant – we can talk about these microbes later, but probably people have heard about lactobacillus because we talk about it for the gut too. A lactobacillus dominant microbiome in the uterus, they had – between 5 and 10 times success with getting pregnant, staying pregnant, and having a healthy baby. Wow. Miscarriage rates were about 4 times as high in women who did not have lactobacillus dominance in their microbiome. And then now they've done studies where they can treat that. They can test it, they can find it, they can treat it. And we can talk more about that testing because it's really transformative. Mm-hmm. And not a lot of clinics are doing it still. It is mainstreamed. If you go to like ASRM or the conventional conference for reproductive endocrinologists, you'll find this test on the expo floor, and more docs are starting to do it. But I would say there's a lot that don't know about it, and it can really transform outcomes.
Wow, that is so fascinating. And I feel like it's back to the understanding of the microbiome. Also, I would love your take on this, of it maybe not even being pathogenic, but dysbiotic.
Absolutely.
For people who don't know, you know, a pathogen is the type of bacteria that will make us frankly sick. You know, if you go to your normal doctor, they can test you and be like, oh yeah, you are sick with this thing like Salmonella or Giardia. Mm-hmm. It's like a very obvious pathogen. But what we see a lot in the gut is that there are bacteria that aren't necessarily pathogenic, or they are okay in small amounts, but in the gut, you know, that's okay. In the vagina and the uterus, probably not. But it's more about the relativity of it all together. It's what type of species are there, not necessarily that you have an infection. You might go to your doctor and be like, no, you don't have an infection. You don't have an STD. You don't have this pathogen that they think of, but it's a dysbiosis. It's an imbalance in the bacteria that can cause issues. Is that true in the female reproductive tract as well?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, we see the presence of a lot of microbes in the uterus that we don't know whether they're harmful or not. And I would just call them opportunistic. They can overgrow in the wrong environment, you know, under the conditions that can support their growth. Some of those things are like Streptococcus, Enterobacteriaceae, E. coli, things that you've heard about. And a lot of it actually comes from stool. And we know that you're more likely to have an abnormal vaginal and uterine microbiome if the distance between basically your vagina and your anus is smaller versus larger.
Oh, interesting.
So because there can be easier crossover between those. So there's like almost like, I guess, genetic, we call it risk factors. And then we know that there's sexually transmitted illnesses like chlamydia and gonorrhea, and then also Gardnerella, which is the main culprit for bacterial vaginosis, that like fish odor infection, that also can migrate up into the uterus. And generally, they don't cause a problem. Like the only time you learn about infections in the uterus, we call PID, pelvic inflammatory disease, it's severe symptoms. And they are caused by those microorganisms. But what we're finding now is that so many women carry those and their body kind of keeps it in check, but it does get inflammation stimulated and it gets a little bit inflamed. And we can talk more about why that's so important, but you need a really chill immune system in your uterus to sustain a pregnancy. And so any kind of irritation like that can be a problem.
So yeah, I want to talk about all of that, the microbes, all of it. But my first question is for a woman who's listening to this, you know, they might not have any obvious symptoms. Have they found a connection with vaginal symptoms? So if you are a woman who maybe has those BV type symptoms like odor or some unwanted discharge or maybe a history of that, or I know a lot of patients who are trying to conceive, maybe this isn't necessarily the case, but maybe where they have like a new partner and all of a sudden they're having issues where they didn't before. Is that a correlation to having then issues in the uterus, or does the vagina and the uterus, are they completely separate? To me, it seems like they'd be connected and that you could get a lot of information from checking your vaginal microbiome, or is that not necessarily the case? You really have to check the uterus.
I think it's a super thoughtful question. And this is so new. I mean, we really, the information on this is coming out like in the last 12 to 18 months. So it's very new. There's no clinical guidelines. So I can't say that definitively, but we do see the same beneficial organisms in the vagina and in the uterus as far as families of organisms. And we do see, like I said, that like sexually transmitted illnesses and vaginal or bugs that are related to vaginal infection, like Gardnerella, are problematic in the uterus. So it absolutely makes sense that they migrate. They're connected.
Yeah.
You know, the cervix is not a closed door. It's connected.
Yeah.
So absolutely. And I would say if you're a woman who has unexplained infertility and you have a history of sexually transmitted illness or a history of vaginal infections, even one, I think this is worth looking at. Because it's just, we're really at the tip of the iceberg and the treatment for it is not difficult and it's really effective. That if you are, especially if you're undergoing IVF and paying tens of thousands of dollars, do the protocol, whether or not you test. It's just, I think it just makes so much sense.
Yeah, I agree. And theoretically, I would imagine that if an imbalanced vaginal microbiome could potentially affect the uterus, that a more balanced vaginal microbiome could positively impact the uterus? Or is this something where you actually have to kill and get rid of the bad bacteria? Can you walk us through? Well, actually, let's first talk about testing.
Okay.
You can just know, and then we'll talk about how to support it.
So the main testing that's done now, which if you have access to it, I would recommend if you're in this category, is called an Emma Alice, like the two girls' names. Emma, I might mix these up, but Emma looks at the beneficial microorganisms and like the healthy microbiome. The Alice looks for pathogens. And I might have those flip-flopped because they're always done together. And that is done through endometrial biopsy. So that's tricky because it's very invasive. Usually, I mean, it's like it can be done when you're awake, but it's not comfortable. They, you know, use a punch biopsy like through the cervix. it's definitely an invasive procedure. But sometimes you're doing endometrial testing anyway, especially if you've had failed transfers, where you could ask to have this added on. And you could also do it, you know, you could ask for it anyway if you were in that group of unexplained infertility. I think with those patients, it's worth doing. Mm-hmm. It's a specialty lab that does it. They send back the results. And the data is really amazing. So the most common bacteria they find is Gardnerella vaginalis, which is that BV bacteria. But the studies on like the test and treat studies that this lab has published, one of them was about 400 women who'd had repeated implantation failure. When they tested this with that Emma Alice test, about 44% had that Gardnerella infection at low grade. And what they did was they looked at using oral probiotics, vaginal probiotics, and antibiotics. And they used different combinations of therapy. So oral probiotics and prebiotics had a 30% cure rate.
Whoa.
Which is not bad. Just an oral probiotic with prebiotics. This is like the same stuff you and I are recommending all the time.
Yeah.
If you added vaginal probiotics had about a 45% cure rate.
Wow.
And then antibiotics only had a 30% cure rate. But when you combine antibiotics with vaginal probiotics and oral probiotics, it was almost an 80% cure rate. And wow, this is all like over-the-counter. I mean, an antibiotic obviously isn't, but it would be one round of antibiotics, about 10 days. So nothing that's outside the ordinary, taken with an oral probiotic and then a woman's probiotic inserted vaginally. So really amazing outcomes with a pretty low level intervention, particularly when you're thinking about the suffering, and the cost of IVF and all this stuff that couples are going through. And so I really think about couples that have had, you know, if you're trying to conceive on your own, you might not know where the problem is. But if you're going through IVF and you have healthy embryos and they're not transferring, this is like the area that I'd be looking at.
100%. And I feel like it would be so easy. This is the one thing that really shocked me when we went through our IVF journey was how much the IVF clinics could be supporting more with simple things you know, obviously better supplements, some dietary recommendations, but something like this, because they almost always give you an antibiotic anyways, you know, to do IVF. It's like, why not follow it up with an amazing vaginal probiotic and oral probiotic, you know, that could potentially change outcomes so much. So
right, from 30% success to almost 80% success. Yeah. I mean, that's incredible.
It's so simple and easy. If it was a medication, it would be done in a heartbeat.
Right, no kidding. And what does it cost? It costs like $60 to go through. I mean, it's like a no-brainer.
It's crazy. I love that. Okay, so the Emma Alice is a wonderful test to actually test the uterus. I know there's a company, and you might know this better than me, called Fertilisys. They're out of Greece. Is that doing the same thing? Or that's – because I know
– they use menstrual blood.
Okay. Is that effective or not really?
It's not. There's no studies on it. I'm super interested in it. And I actually think that the idea of using menstrual blood to do this kind of testing is really innovative. And I think it could be a successful strategy. You have to find a way to get it without having it being, you know, like a clean catch with urine. You need a clean catch of menstrual blood to be able to get the microbiome. But it is the shedding of the lining. So it should be representative of the microbiome. And so, I mean, I think it's a really viable piece. There's also a lot of vaginal swabs out there, which don't test the uterus. It doesn't always align, but I do think that it's worth looking at because we do know there is relationship between the vaginal microbiome and the uterine microbiome. And if you pick up a pathogen in the vaginal microbiome, you should be going through a treatment.
Yeah.
In fact, I mean, with my clients that have unexplained infertility, I put them on the oral plus vaginal probiotics.
Yeah.
Just as part of their plan. It's part of my transfer protocol. I think it's an easy thing to say yes to.
Yeah, I agree. And speaking of that, what are the types of probiotics that are helpful? What kind of species have they found? Because I know there's a lot of different types of lactobacillus. Does it matter?
There are, well, for the uterus, for the uterine microbiome, it's a variety of lactobacilli. When it comes to vaginal probiotics, there were initially like two strains that were really well studied. It was a product called Femdophilus by Jaro, which is over the counter. You can get at Whole Foods. I still love recommending that product because they invested a ton of money in the research out mm-hmm. there and really changed our knowledge. So I always like to give back to the companies that are giving to our medical community and to our patients with yeah. the information. So that's a really great one. There are stronger ones out there as well that have the same two research strains. And now actually there are other probiotics that contain the strains that are specific to the vaginal community, because Femdophilus was like before that. It was yeah. primarily studied for prevention and treatment of urinary tract infections, which mm-hmm. it's really effective for too. But we're looking at Lactobacillus crispatus, Einers, Gasseri, and Jensenii. Those are the four main strains. But really a lot of different Lactobacillus, different species can exist in the vaginal vault. So when you are shopping, you can see a lot of them labeled women's probiotics. Mm-hmm. Those are generally designed for this. And actually, Femdophilus has another one that has those four vaginal strains. Vitanica has a great product that has those vaginal strains. So there's a lot out there that could work. And I generally use the oral capsules vaginally.
Yeah.
You don't have to buy anything special. You just take them by mouth and insert them vaginally.
What about Lactobacillus rhamnosus and reuteri? Are those still helpful or less so?
They haven't studied the strain specific when it comes to fertility specifically. Mm-hmm. But yes, those are the ones that are studied that are part of that Femdophilus product.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I know those two have been shown to help a lot with even like group B strep and stuff in pregnancy. And so
totally. I mean, we could talk about that too. There's like so much that they can be used for.
Yeah, amazing. I love that so much. Okay, so if you're someone who is struggling with unexplained infertility or you're doing IVF transfers, they're failing, you know, considering doing these tests, the best and most effective test would probably be that Emma Alice. Other options, potentially this Fertilisys or even a vaginal microbiome test just to kind of get a pulse on it and maybe just, you know, approaching it from this treatment perspective. Is there anything else that you would say or tell someone about that or anything else that we are seeing other than the microbiome impacting the health of the uterus or, you know, the immune system in that regard? Is there any other clue on any other testing that can tell us like an hsCRP or other inflammatory markers, or are those generally not going to show up if it's a uterine issue?
So there's no published data on this, but I always look at any signs of inflammation and autoimmunity. So I look at hsCRP, I look at sedimentation rate. These are kind of general markers for inflammation. And then I also look at autoimmune screens. So there is data showing that women who have elevated thyroid antibodies, even if their TSH and their thyroid function is normal, the presence of antibodies is linked with a higher rate of infertility. Mm-hmm. We don't know why the correlation hasn't been, or the connection, the understanding of why that happens hasn't been discovered and published thoroughly. Mm-hmm. But it's likely due to, it can be autoimmunity in the ovary affecting mm-hmm. the development of healthy eggs and embryos. But I think probably it also relates to the heightened immune system that we see in autoimmunity in the impact within the uterus. Because remember, in order for a blastocyst to implant in the wall of the uterus, the immune system of mom has to kind of ignore the fact that it's foreign tissue, because it's half mm-hmm. DNA from mom, but half DNA from the sperm. So mm-hmm. it is foreign. And there are a lot of special things that happen that are really cool that allow that blastocyst to kind of override the local immune function. But if the immune system's volume's turned up, I suspect that what we're seeing is that it's not effective enough, because there's this heightened immune system. There's more natural killer cells out there. There's more of that kind of that militia of our immune system out there looking for foreign tissue, and it's more acute and it finds it. So mm-hmm. I am also looking at things to calm down inflammation generally and really assist with bringing down the overall inflammation in the body. That's like things like fish oil, turmeric, and curcumin. There's a lot that we can use.
Yeah. So if I'm just thinking of a patient right now off the top of my head, you know, a positive ANA, no obvious signs of autoimmunity, but an hsCRP that's elevated, you know, typically we're also looking at the gut to be like, what's going on there? But do you think a picture like that could be showing enough to potentially investigate the uterus, or it's just really hard to say?
Yeah, it's hard to say, but I don't know that you need to test the uterine microbiome, but I think if they're showing signs of inflammation, that should be looked at. Mm-hmm. And we know that gut dysfunction is a big piece of that for a lot of patients, that dysbiosis that you talked about. And gut microbiome is also related to fertility in a lot of ways. One through inflammation, another one through hormone change. There's so many things that can happen when there's gut dysbiosis.
I know. I feel like it's such a fascinating thing when you talk to a doctor who is more segmented, you know, they're a cardiologist or they're you know, a gastroenterologist or, you know, an OB-GYN. And there is sort of, it's lost a little bit, I think, in our conventional model of how everything's connected, because if you have inflammation from one place, it can infect these other organs. Like, you don't necessarily have to have a specific even infection in the uterus to have inflammation that could be affecting the uterus.
That's right.
And it could be in the gut, and the gut can affect the heart and all of it. And I think that that is kind of a missed thing in our medical system, which I think is what sadly impacts everyone in a big way. And why fertility is complicated, because
it's so complicated.
To help fertility is not just to help the reproductive organs. You have to treat the whole person.
Another surprising microbiome when it comes to fertility and pregnancy is the oral microbiome.
Oh, tell us more about that.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors. There are so many factors that impact egg quality. Stress, toxins, and energy issues are just a few. Stress and toxins increase oxidative damage that negatively impact your eggs, and eggs need adequate mitochondrial energy to mature properly. It's so important to support your eggs no matter where you are along your fertility journey. I personally love Needed's egg support product to do just that. I helped design this formula, so I obviously love it, but even if I hadn't, it would be the one I would recommend to my patients and clients. This formula is an antioxidant and mitochondrial powerhouse that supports oxidative damage and the energy powerhouses, mitochondria. It has key ingredients like L-carnitine, green tea extract, PQQ, and ALA. I love pairing it with Needed's prenatal to get your essential nutrients, as well as their CoQ10 for an antioxidant boost. Visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER at checkout to save 20% off your first order. Again, visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20%. Okay, now back to the show.
Yeah. So in fact, when they look at like preterm birth, mom's oral microbiome is linked with like whether a mom will carry to term or not.
Wow.
Yeah. It's really fascinating. And so they've looked at this like her third trimester, but also the prenatal or the preconception timeframe is super important to work on mom's oral microbiome, because the placental microbiome, the placenta actually has a microbiome too, looks just like mom's oral microbiome.
What?
Yeah. The placental microbiome impacts the health of the placenta, which impacts the competence of the placenta and whether it's able to like sustain. Because remember, it basically, you birth it after the baby, it degrades over time. But we know that when there's insufficient placenta, it's like the baby's not getting the blood supply it needs. It's linked to low birth weight. It's linked to preterm birth. But who would think the oral microbiome is so critically important?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, and do you have any tips or ideas of how to improve the oral microbiome, or is there a way to test that to know if it's good or bad? Or
I don't know that you need to test it, but I always recommend, like, women should never do perio cleanings, which is like the intensive gum cleaning during pregnancy. That's a really bad idea, because that mobilizes a lot of the bacteria that may be stored. If you have inflammation in your gums, or you've been told you have periodontitis, you need to treat it before you get pregnant. I always check with that when patients are coming in thinking they want to get pregnant. That's the time to do the perio cleanings and get it taken care of. Mm-hmm. Then you want to just focus on good oral hygiene. So no alcohol-based mouthwashes, because guess what alcohol does? Strips your microbiome.
Yeah, the good guys too.
The good guys too. So making sure that you like floss. Flossing's so important. Mm-hmm. And do whatever you need to do. My husband was making fun of me, because I would set floss. Flossing was like my New Year's resolution for like 3 years, because I just couldn't get into the habit of doing it every day.
I know. It's so hard.
It's so hard. So this year for Christmas, I bought myself this like bougie vibrating flosser.
That's amazing.
Called a slate flosser. And I was starting to get inflammation in my gums too. Not periodontitis, but they were always irritated. Mm-hmm. And my dentist, when I went in for my cleaning this summer, which has been like 6 months of regular use, she's like, I don't know what you've been doing, but keep doing it. It looks great.
Oh, good.
So floss before you brush. and use like a healthy toothpaste. I think they're like the hydroxyapatite based toothpaste are awesome.
It dries well and stuff.
Yeah. And then lastly, eat a lot of fiber. That's like the other thing that's so big. Like just eat tons of fruits and vegetables and lots of fiber. And that's really great for the oral microbiome, just like the gut.
I love that. The other thing I'll add to that, which I don't know if you know much about or agree with me or not, but if you're a mouth breather, that can also change your microbiome.
Yeah.
So, mouth tape, I know it sounds so silly. And obviously you can get to the root of like why you're a mouth breather, which comes to like, you know, airway issues. Like there's so many rabbit holes you can go down, but a simple fix without having to do all of that is just literally tape your mouth shut at night, because that breathing through your mouth also really changes the microbiome and can help a lot, not only with the microbiome, but with sleep. So I don't know if you have anything to say.
A huge one. I'm glad you brought that up. And yeah, it's huge because you need moisture to maintain the microbiome in the mouth. And when you breathe by mouth, it dries out and it totally changes the microbes. Tongue scraping is another thing that can be really helpful. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just kind of eating healthy foods and taking care of your mouth.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And as you're talking about all of this, I'm like thinking of sex too, and just how much sex and oral sex and all different types of places and things that people do could potentially impact the microbiome. And like if people use toys and making sure that they're clean and, you know, washing your hands before you change your tampon and just other things that I don't know if people think about as much. You know, I know when I was a teenager, I used to go change my tampon, and you don't wash your hands before, you wash your hands after. And I had this thought, I'm like, oh my gosh, I need to go wash my hands. Like, I'm about to go change my tampon and I haven't washed my hands yet. Like, what did I just bring into my vagina area?
Totally right. You're totally right. And even like the order of sexual activity, right?
Yes.
Like, if you're going to do things that are going to, you know, you don't want to be moving microbiomes. Let's just leave it at that. Well, we won't change the
microbiomes in their own categories. Yes.
Keep your microbiomes where they belong.
It is interesting how that could potentially impact, and just being more mindful, you know, of that kind of stuff too.
And you're right. Just like wash afterward. Like if you use a toy, wash it afterward. Don't, you know, let it sitting around. Also, if you're trying to conceive, you have to think about if you're using a lube, what kind of lube you use, and using a safe lube. There's the one that I recommend most is called Baby Dance, which is a paraben-free fertility safe lube. But there's one – you can probably get Baby Dance now in a lot of places. Does Good Clean Love have one? Do you know that's
fertility safe? Good Clean Love is pretty good. Yeah, they have a fertility safe one. And when – you can talk about this too, but fertility safe is usually about the pH and toxicity. But this is something to bring up, which I'm sure you would speak about, but as we're talking about lubes, because I love to talk about this stuff. But with couples who are trying to conceive, you know, around conception time when you're trying to actually have the baby, you want the pH to be higher because sperm like it higher. But the vagina doesn't like it higher. So I've had patients where outside of the window of trying to conceive, you might have to go back to a lower pH lube to protect your vaginal microbiome, because when you only use that high pH lube all the time, then it can start to disrupt your vaginal microbiome again. It's like all sorts of things that you learn after trying to conceive for 6 years, because you, if it's out of the window of conception when the sperm doesn't matter as much, then you might want to go back to those lower pH lubes. But yeah, Baby Dance is great, and Good Clean Love has ones that are bio-matching, which would be the lower pH, not what you would want to do when you're in the ovulation window. And then they do have a higher pH fertility-friendly one. But you might have to mix up your lube to keep your whole everything good to go. It's so annoying.
It's a lot to have to juggle.
I know. It's crazy. But that's another thing. Let's talk about pH and the vaginal microbiome. Do you see a lot of impacts with that?
Definitely. So, well, we know with when it comes to vaginal infections, like you said, pH is really important. The vagina tends to be more acidic, and that's because it's really predominant with those lactobacillus strains that we talked about earlier. And lactobacillus in the name, lacto is the fact that they produce lactic acid, and that lactic acid keeps the pH low, and it's very protective. They also produce other things. They have like bacteriocins that the bacteria produce that are less general. So pH is like a general protection because a lot of bacteria can't survive there. But there's actually specific proteins that are made by these vaginal probiotics that actually target specific pathogens like HIV. There's ones for HIV. There's ones for gonorrhea and chlamydia. So these are very specific. They have a narrow window of activity, but they're stronger. And they also make hydrogen peroxide. Wow. So they make a lot of compounds that protect the vaginal vault from infection. So the microbes play a huge role in that as well. And we also know about the impact with like the urinary tract. So like all of that kind of genito-urinary area is really important to be paying attention to microbiome. So if you have recurrent vaginal infections, recurrent UTIs, if you're getting those more than twice a year, you probably have a problem with the vaginal microbiome that could be corrected, and then you could be better.
Wow, that's amazing. What about boric acid? Do you ever recommend that?
Yeah, boric acid can be great for treatment. There's a lot of good options available in the suppository form. Mm-hmm. But boric acid is an easy one. It's available over the counter. Mm-hmm. The only thing I would just caution women against is like using raw garlic, which I see on forums and stuff a lot. I've seen women who actually get tissue burns from the garlic, and it can be quite painful. So I do recommend sometimes garlic capsules. Mm-hmm. It's like a garlic extract, but I would not use raw garlic. And then also a lot of women use yogurt vaginally, which is full of lactobacillus. And I don't have any problem with that other than it's quite messy and you don't need to go through that. You can get a probiotic and get a higher dose without it being so messy.
Yeah. And I would think in case if you're using the wrong kind of yogurt, the sugar would maybe feed like yeast. And then you'd maybe
get it's like you use like a plain yogurt. I've seen that a lot. I mean, and again, that is kind of the old naturopathic therapy. Right. Probiotics. So
that's so interesting. Oh, that's so cool. Okay. So the microbiome is a big deal. Oral microbiome, like you said, other things with the immune system, any other factors or things that you've seen that are impacting that maybe our listeners maybe wouldn't know, you know, whether it's, I don't know, something else in relation to getting pregnant in that regard or something else about the immune system?
Well, I think with microbiome specifically, like what you put on and use is really important. So like Tori Hudson, who's one of my mentors, she says the vagina is a self-cleaning organ. You know, it's like you don't need to use a douche. You don't need to use soaps. Just like very gentle. Just be very gentle. You don't need to put anything on there. You don't want to smell like, you know, a fresh spring.
Yeah.
A vagina should smell like a vagina. You know, it's like, that's just, you know, it's just what it is. So don't put anything on that could be disruptive. Also, the type of underwear that you wear makes a difference. You want breathability. So generally cotton is better. Like think about what you're wearing for pants, like nothing tight, nothing restrictive, nothing polyester or sweaty. And I always recommend to women who are prone to infections that they sleep without underwear. Like you sleep in like loose shorts or something instead to like let the air get to it. So don't need to be, you know, just make sure that you're kind of monitoring temperature and stuff like that.
Do you have any favorite brands for cotton underwear or anything like that?
Not really. I mean, you can just check the label. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
You can get them at Target. Like, I mean, yeah, it's harder to find because everything's blended now. But
I know. I feel like Pact has
Pact is awesome.
I feel like
the shape and comfort of Pact is not always.
I know. I was going to say it's like it's good. And also at the beginning, they maybe changed things. When I first ordered it, I feel like a lot of my underwear like fell apart. But I was like willing to keep giving it a try. But yeah, if anyone has any good ones, you just reach out to us on Instagram and let us know because it's a hard one to find, but important. And there are some at Target that are like only 5% of something else and like 95% cotton, which, you know, is better than a full polyester blend. I used to be the classic go to Victoria's Secret and get those like 5 undies for 25 or whatever. And they're all like unbreathable, very polyester.
Well, you would laugh, but those are the ones that I have. But I will not tell you how old they are live on this podcast. I know. But it was back when they used to use cotton. I'll just say that. And they're
amazing.
So comfortable. You know how like when you wear a t-shirt for a long time, it gets thin and gets even softer? It's like that.
That should be the next frontier because I know Victoria's Secret has pulled in more of like a body diversity branding. Mm. They should be like, we now have healthy material because
I feel amazing.
Like they dominate the underwear industry so much, you know, especially with younger women. And once you get onto a brand, you kind of just stick with it for so long. So yeah, maybe
I like that idea.
Anyone listening works for Victoria's Secret. Let them know.
We have ideas.
I know. What about men? Is the male partner's microbiome play a role at all, or is it kind of not impactful?
Yeah, there's not as much research on the male microbiome, but the sperm, there is a seminal microbiome as well. So it does have an impact. I don't have as much data on it because it's just not covered.
Yeah.
But certainly it's important to be thinking about that. And I think about all the same things with women. And I also think about like women who get vaginal infections after intercourse with a partner. Yeah. Like it could be a microbiome thing. So even for males, I would think about taking like an oral probiotic, just like a regular gut focused probiotic.
Yeah.
Because that's a great place to start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With, like overall. Maybe checking if you find something, maybe treating him to some degree because he could just give it back. We do
see that happens all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about people? I know this is not as common, but for someone who has unexplained infertility, do you see ever, or is there any more research coming out about immune incompatibility with each other, like self autoimmune to your own reproductive cells, like sperm or eggs, or to your partner's? Is that a common thing or not so much?
It does happen. As far as is it common? I've never seen prevalence data, but they used to do what they called post-coital testing. Do you remember hearing about this?
I feel like
it was done in like the early days of fertility, where they would have a female like go into her OBGYN after having unprotected intercourse, and they would actually draw up the fluid that was like combined cervical fluid and semen and look at it under a microscope to try to see how many sperm were surviving. Because have you ever heard the term? It's like hostile mucus. I love that term.
No, but I mean, for the people who are really struggling and can't figure it out, I feel like these little things are things to think about. Like,
yeah, well, they don't do that. They don't do the post-coital testing anymore. They found that it doesn't really have as much validity. But we do know that like men make antibodies to their own sperm. Women can make antibodies to their partner's sperm. And of course, women, we know there's many kinds of autoimmunity. This is another area where there's a lot of research, but there's ovarian autoantibodies that have been detected.
Wow.
There's other, you know, we know that there's tissue-specific antibodies that women can make in their own reproductive tissue. Of course, that makes sense because we can make them to our pancreas in diabetes, to our thyroid, to our skin. You can have autoimmune reactions anywhere. So yeah, of course you can have it in the ovaries and uterus.
Right.
It's just not really been discovered yet. So one thing that's nice about that is that when you identify there's inflammation, the protocols that we use in naturopathic medicine for autoimmunity, it doesn't really matter what the target tissue is because we're treating the immune system.
Yeah.
You might be supporting that tissue too, but you're really treating the immune system. So we can help even if it's not, you know, diagnosed with a lab test.
Yeah. I love that. Amazing. There's so much good information that is new. I love learning all the new stuff. What else? Is there any other new things? Like if you were at a conference and you were saying, this is what we've learned in the last 10 years, you know, is there anything else that feels crazy or different? Or
I think the other area that is maybe not crazy or different, but I think it's worth mentioning because it's probably the thing that I see the most and do the most in practice, and it's the area that we're able to have a huge impact, is helping women who are like, let's say mid-30s to mid-40s that are trying to conceive, where they're facing a reduction in like the ovarian reserve, or they're finding that they have a lot of miscarriages, or just lower quality eggs, lower responsiveness of the ovaries. There's a lot that can be done with that. You must know, you see this too all the time. What are your favorites to think about for that?
For like low ovarian reserve and stuff?
Yeah. And for, you know, just kind of supporting egg quality and sperm quality.
Oh gosh. Well, I want to know what you do. Okay. I know more of the like newer things. I mean, outside of lifestyle based stuff, I know like you mentioned like PRP. I know that there's some different things that people are doing in that regard. I know that there's a lot of the kind of anti-aging, mitochondrial supportive practices that people are doing that can be helpful, and like red lights and things like that. But I want to know what you know, because you like know all the cool stuff.
Well, I think there's some really good basics. So nutritionally, I think about like fish oil, multivitamin, all those basics. But then there are some like specialty nutrients that I've seen be really impactful. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see studies come out on it, particularly in sperm. But sperm and egg are like essentially, if one is helpful to sperm, another, it's going to be most likely helpful to the egg as well. One of them is nicotinamide riboside, which is under the brand name Niagen. But now there's like all these related compounds that you can get that it's not the branded ingredient, and they're okay as well. But that really, it helps with mitochondrial function. And one thing that's really amazing is that the ovaries and the testes have more mitochondria than like any other tissue. And mitochondria are energy producing cells. And you just think about how much energy it takes to basically take a germ cell and turn it into like a single cell that will become an entire human.
Yeah.
That's crazy. A lot of work, right? It's a lot of effort. Crazy. So the mitochondria are there to really protect. And if you support mitochondria, you're probably going to see an improvement. In fact, probably the most well-researched nutrient for sperm besides like zinc and vitamin C is CoQ10.
Yeah.
And we see that with eggs too, but like up to 600 milligrams a day, you get this linear benefit in sperm quality. And I see that with eggs as well. Mm-hmm. So CoQ10, that's kind of an old nutrient, but still one of my favorites.
Yeah. It's an oldie, but a goodie because our bodies are what they are. And, you know, I'm not as big into like all of the newest, latest tech stuff. I'm kind of like you, like back to the basics in certain ways because the body needs what it needs, right? It needs its building blocks. It needs its co-founders. Mm-hmm. It needs all of these things. And the one punch that I stand on my soapbox and I will always do it is if anyone's listening and you haven't listened to any of our other content, if you are going through IVF, it is still important to support the male partner.
Oh my gosh. It's so important.
I mean, it's important if you're trying to conceive naturally as well. But I think sometimes people are like, oh, I'm just going to do IVF. I'm kind of off the hook as the man or whatever.
Did you find that attitude when you're going through IVF? I mean, obviously your partner was super involved, but do you see that in practice a lot?
100%. I see it from the doctors, which shocks me. I see it from patients, rightfully so. They don't really realize, or they think like, okay, we've been trying for so long, and a lot of times the man's not even brought into the conversation at all. And they just kind of are pushed into IVF. And then they're just like, okay, this is going to solve it, X, Y, Z. And it's one of the biggest things that I just want to scream from the rooftop is even if you go through IVF, which hopefully, you know, you don't need to, but if you have to, then the man is, his sperm still matters.
It still matters.
Any improvement, like you said, just getting him on a CoQ10, 600 milligrams, can make a huge difference in quality. Maybe he doesn't have the biggest count of sperm ever, or, you know, whatever the issue or obstacle is for you going through that, his DNA still matters. It's the biggest thing that blows my mind that they don't care or like think about it. Not the people, but the IVF clinics. That's what I was so shocked by, because ours was male factor. And I remember even talking to one of the male reproductive urologists. There's only a few. We met with most of them. And I would ask them questions like, what recommendations do you make for your patients, you know, to improve their outcomes? And they're like, nothing. Like, I mean, the one was like, you could maybe take a Centrum vitamin, but I don't think it does anything. And I'm just like, are you kidding? Do you not even read your own research? This is so weird. So yeah, I think that's one thing that people just forget, that it takes two no matter which route of fertility you're going down. And that, like you said, supporting the mitochondria. And if you're on a budget, yeah, whatever she's taking to support her egg quality, you could probably take to support your sperm quality. It's so similar. But I just have to do that little soapbox because I feel so passionate about it.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing your personal experience. And I couldn't agree more, because I think, you know, it's one of the heartbreaking aspects of fertility to see as a provider and as a woman, because, you know, when we know women take over in most relationships, women take over the majority of like child rearing and all the household stuff. But it starts with fertility. When a couple is trying to conceive, there is this attitude. Maybe it's our type A personalities as women that come in that are like, we can fix this.
Yeah.
But, or maybe it's societal, you know, it's a combination of things. And there actually is data on this, that the knowledge between men and women on fertility is remarkably different. There are also, if you look at clinics, there are far less materials targeted to men than to women. Mm-hmm. When doctors speak to a couple, they speak to the woman, not the male. There's all these things that have been published that show a gender bias when it comes to fertility. And ultimately, statistically, the irony of it is that it's 50-50 when it comes to who's responsible for infertility when you look across populations. And so,
yeah.
When I was seeing patients regularly, I required both partners to come in for the first visit.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, and again, I think another big thing is with IVF, there's a procedure called ICSI, which is intracytoplasmic sperm injection. And it really became like a cop-out in a lot of ways, because when men had poor quality sperm, rather than say, there's a problem here. We need to improve your sperm health so you can have a healthy baby. They would be like, that's okay. We have this procedure. We can just take one. Mm-hmm. And if it's not healthy enough to fertilize an egg, we'll just inject it into the egg and fertilize it for you. And while it does work, it's doesn't make sense to me. And this gets to that root cause. Why not treat the root cause?
Yep.
Because you want healthier sperm. So for men too, I mean, I think get a semen analysis. There's another test called DNA fragmentation that's really important to look at. That is not always automatically ordered that you should be looking at. And definitely get involved. It's like this is your first project as parents together. Mm-hmm. And it definitely matters. In fact, not only for the outcomes for the baby, but another kind of interesting thing, and all the data is on men here. What we're seeing now is that infertility in men or sperm parameters being suboptimal or even the low range of normal is the canary in the coal mine. It is the first thing you can identify in men that indicates they are going to have more chronic disease sooner in life. So in your 30s, if you have or younger even, if you don't have great sperm, you are statistically more likely to develop type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, several different kinds of cancer, and all-cause mortality. That means you're going to die sooner. Yeah. It is all connected to sperm health. And that's because that is the most sensitive marker we have for overall health, inflammation, oxidative stress levels, all that. So I actually think that you could argue that men should have semen analysis done as part of a wellness exam.
Oh, 100%.
This is such a good marker.
Oh my God. That would be – that is part of my utopia world.
Yes. Well, it's a great marker. The data is really clear.
Oh yeah, 100%. And how could it not be? Because it's reflective of hormonal health. You know, if you have low testosterone, then you're going to have poor quality issues with sperm or low count. A mitochondrial health marker. I mean, how often do you get to see a cell, a representation of a cell of the body, of like how well it's doing with markers like, does it move? Does it look good?
No, you know? Yeah.
That's amazing. If you could so cool. pluck a cell out of your body and be like, how healthy is this really? And what is this functional marker of what's going on? I think it's brilliant. And the biggest and saddest thing that I see in the fertility space is how long it takes couples to start looking at the man, and then how long it takes to make changes that if we had just started sooner. It's another soapbox that I will, you know, die on. But I experienced personally that gender bias like you talked about. I mean, even when we were going through our infertility, you know, we'd go together and they would look at me right away and be like, so what's wrong? You know, like to me, like what's wrong with you? And I'd be like, oh, it's not me actually. It's my husband. Like it's just so shocking to people. But like you said, it's 50% and miscarriage too. I think people forget about that. Are you seeing any data, more data? I feel like men are the next frontier, even though they are probably not, because there's still so much shame around it in our culture and all of that. But from figuring out what's going on, I feel like men are a big part of that. Have you seen much new research or anything about their role? Because I know in miscarriage it's coming out, and even their role in nausea and pregnancy and all sorts of stuff.
It's really wild, all the connections they're making. But yeah, in miscarriage, actually, it's suggestive that sperm health may be more impactful, actually, than female factor, which is really wild because you're thinking about the woman carrying the pregnancy. But male factor is really important. I do think that the stigma is changing, and you know, we can all have a part in that by just involving our partners and encouraging them to get involved and like letting them take the lead on things.
Yeah.
Getting them involved, getting them learning. But I do think that like the biohacking movement is changing the way men talk about health. And they're, you know, classically, we learned when I was in school that women were like 70 to 80% of the healthcare consumer. And when the partners came in, it was usually instigated by their female partner.
Yep.
But I think that's really starting to change, and men are taking a lot more personal responsibility for that health, and younger generations even more so. Yeah. So I'm really hopeful that that will shift. And I think that doctors now, we are changing the bias in the way that we treat couples. And, you know, I think couples can step up and do that together. And really, I do think about this. I've had some patients where it's like hard to see a couple because they're not working together and the male partner is not engaged at all. And, you know, I'm not a therapist, but I'm kind of like, we can't work together on this. Like, how's it going to happen when the baby comes out? But I do think that if you're a man listening to this, or you're a woman listening and you have a male partner, getting involved and making this a team effort can be one of like the most rewarding things that you can do together. And while if it's a male factor or female factor doesn't matter, like maybe the male partner like fills your little supplement cups every week, like get them involved. Everyone can be involved. But the things I think about in the lifestyle are like cooking, shopping for healthy food, going to the farmer's market together, cleaning up your environment, avoiding toxins, like get a water filter, get an air purifier, avoiding toxic beauty products. I see women take so much care oftentimes. And my husband, I just have to like throw away the Axe body spray. He brings
home Axe. Oh my gosh.
I'm like, no, they cannot use this. You know, use these instead. You know, I'm like, stop buying this. But now that he knows, he's super invested in it too. So
yeah.
I think we need as women to be more supportive and like inviting to be working on this as a team. And I think ultimately it's a very rewarding project to work on together.
I love that so much. I have one last thing to say and then we'll wrap up. And that's in for some of the patients I've seen, if you're having a hard time motivating your partner, one thing to remind them, I don't know if a lot of people make this connection, like we've mentioned, everything's connected, that it's not just fertility. Like you said about how sperm is a marker of all these things, you know, remind him if he takes these supplements or does these things to improve his fertility, what that ultimately is doing is improving his testosterone, which will make him have a better sex life and have more libido and feel better, have more energy, be able to be stronger, have more motivation, you know, be able to live longer. And I think that sometimes people just put fertility in this box and they're like, oh, this is this thing, or like, I don't want to have children, so then this doesn't matter, when it's like you have the reproductive parts, whether you choose to use them or not, and they impact you. And there's so much there. So I think using it as more of like, this isn't your just role to just get me pregnant once and be done. Like really take your fertility as a marker, like you said, of improving it is not just to get us pregnant, but to help you and your health too. And I think that's a big paradigm shift that if more people knew and had, would make a difference too.
I love it. Tell them it'll make them hotter.
Yeah, exactly. I love it. Oh my gosh, this has been such a great conversation. You're such a wealth of knowledge. I always love talking to you. I feel like you just, you know, you have so much wisdom and knowledge, which is hard to find, you know, these days. And to have you here is just so special to me. So thank you. And thank you for sharing everything that you did.
Yeah, it means a lot to me to be here. I love what you and Morgan are doing and just opening up all the conversations that matter to women and to moms. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll probably have you back to chat with Morgan about motherhood stuff.
Sounds fun.
Awesome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.